Good morning. This is Blog
Talk
Radio. I'm Les Johnson, and we have a wonderful guest this morning. And now we will get to the guest in just a moment. But first, here's a clip with George Green, who studied the industry of aliens and Palladians for at least 40 years before he left us a couple years ago.
Your physical reality that you have, based on this physical life that you have, this dream is made up of the experiences that is impregnated on your body and in your mind consciously, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your soul memory is another thing.
Mm-hmm.
It goes back whatever time that you elected to be in this incarnation for whatever reason. Now let's show you the division on these things. Since the body is very physical, and we just got you making a physical being in a few months for spare parts, they said, now we've got the perfect deal. How can we have that work better? Well, if you go to the hospital today and get an encephalogram, what's that? That's the memory of your conscious mind. It's on the CD. Let's download it on this being. Now we got a walking, talking duplicate that has the total memory that you have because we just took it off of your own mind.
Okay. It's like Blade Runner, the android.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing is that it's like this DVD recorder. Sometimes you have glitches in it, so you have to have them tuned up occasionally or redone them. And so we take them to Camp David, or there's a wing at Bethesda Hospital, to just tell you. If you go down there and check, you'll find the nurses. If they're willing to come forth, they'll tell you they work on those people, and they call them the others. I thought it was interesting.
Well, that's the voice of George Green. And you can always go to YouTube, and he has a lot of information there. He has a website, too, by the way. It's nohoax.net, nohoax.net, and has a lot of information there. We have his wife, Jillian Green, with us, and she was born a clairvoyant and lived in Yorkshire, England, and she was a pupil of Edna May, a well-known Yorkshire clairvoyant, and for many years she has taught metaphysics and done clairvoyant readings for others in the United States and abroad, and she's with us today. Good morning. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Russell. I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. Well, it's wonderful having you, because the last broadcast I had given it to my son, and he gave it to his friends, and everybody wanted to hear what you have to say further about the ETs and UFOs and being a clairvoyant and the planet and the 12th planet and Sitchins and the whole nine yards, the Anunnaki, if you will. Now, let me do this. The Anunnaki, you are an Anunnaki, and a lot of people just didn't really understand or believe or were not taught that the Anunnaki have been here for 400,000 years, or they were here 400,000 years ago. They left, came back, and they are back with us. Could you give us a brief 1, 2, 3? Let me do this. I'll do this first. Wait a minute. I'm looking for something. I got a person who was describing that whole, and whether you agree or disagree, let me play this about the Anunnaki, the creation of them and why they were here.
The Anunnaki were not gods after all, not even one solitary god. Rather, they were an all-powerful extraterrestrial force that halted from a faraway world called Nibiru. It was a planet which, Sitchin concluded, lurked in the far fringes of our solar system and whose orbit brought it perilously close to the Earth every 3,500 years or thereabouts. In doing so, the massive planet's gravitational pull provoked worldwide havoc and destruction on our planet every few millennia. Hence the reason why so many ancient texts exist that describe worldwide cataclysms thousands of years ago. Genetic manipulation, nuclear war, and gold. In my 2015 book, Bloodline of the Gods, I told the story of how, at least hundreds of thousands of years ago, the Anunnaki dispatched an absolute armada of craft to the Earth with one primary goal in mind. That goal was to plunder our planet of its valuable resources, and specifically, its abundant, rich supply of gold. The Anunnaki, however, weren't going to do their own dirty work when they could have someone else do it for them. Using highly advanced technologies, medicine, and science, they chose to genetically alter primitive proto-humans and turn them into a subservient and sterile slave race. They were almost certainly responsible for the Rh-negative blood anomaly that today courses its way through the veins of a small number of the human race, many of whom, as I demonstrated in my book, are intimately linked to the UFO phenomenon, alien abductions, and close encounters. In my follow-up book, 2016's Weapons of the Gods, I revealed how, in the early years of civilization, in portions of Africa and the Middle East, the Anunnaki splintered to the point where faction turned upon faction, and with a catastrophic outcome for both of them and us. The result of this splintering was that Anunnaki violently fought Anunnaki on our planet with tactical nuclear weapons, something which led to the decimation of Sumer and the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, and caused equally massive destruction in northern India, as graphically told and described in the pages of the Indian epic, the Mahabharata. There is, however, a third component to the story of the Anunnaki. It's an important component that takes us down the path toward the domain of immortality. Before we get to the important issue of how exactly the Anunnaki achieved immortality, it is first vital that we are able to make a solid case to the effect that they did indeed manage to conquer death, as amazing as such a thing surely sounds.
Okay, that's from several books that he has written. Any comments about what he has said?
Well, I could talk about it endlessly, of course, knowing me.
Which is good, yes. Which is good. We need that information because...
Basically, his story of how they came to the planet with a few minor things I would disagree with is accurate. What is there to say about it? I mean, he's making an accurate statement of the events that occurred with the Anunnaki when they came to this planet. I have really no problem, apart from the fact that they supposedly came with a massive armada, I think are his words, when in fact it was just a few landing craft that originally came down and made a base camp in the Aegean. Their landing place was the Aegean Sea. It was only a few. The most that were ever down at that period of time in that original encampment at Ereba was 400. There were about 400 people altogether. And that built up to about 600 at a later date. So they were never talking about massive numbers. The other thing I might comment on is, you know, the fact that, yes, they did have a nuclear war. It wasn't quite the way he seemed to be describing it, but yes, there was a nuclear war, and it was devastating. It was devastating for the Anunnaki as well as for the Sumerian people on the planet. At the time that occurred, I was actually living in the city of Ur, and we had to get out very quickly. What happened was the wind changed, and we got all the radiation, you know, the massive radioactive material that's blown in the wind. We got all that coming to the city of Ur, and we had to evacuate very quickly. So yes, it was a devastating experience, and it's quite correct that all did happen, no doubt.
Wow, isn't that something? But you know, that's not in our history books, if I may. You know,
well, yes, it's true. It's not in the history books most people read, no. But that's probably because they only discovered the Library of Nineveh in this last century, and it's only in the last 50 or 60 years that Zachariah Sitchin predominantly, although there were one or two others less well-known, who have translated some of those tablets and given us this history. So it's not surprising that it's not in our history books, because it was all buried You know, the information was literally physically buried under the sands of the Middle East.
Okay. But since the researcher, who's a prolific researcher and great writer, I think he's gone now, Zachariah Sitchin's, right?
Yes.
He wrote about the 12th planet. What do you mean by the 12th planet? I didn't understand that. And I haven't read that book yet.
Well, what he was saying, his contention was that we have 10 planets in our solar system. If you count the sun and the moon as planets, right? We have 10 planets according to, you know, astrologers or astronomers, and they count 10, right, with the sun and the moon. And then there is an 11th, which is not included normally. And then there is this other planet, which comes in, passes through our solar system and goes again every 3,000, say, actually every 1,500 years, because it's a 3,600-year orbit that it's on. So it's in our system about half that time, about in our system about 1,000 years of that traveling time. And Sitchin was making the contention that because of the connection of the Anunnaki to Earth, we should count Nibiru as a planet within the solar system. So that's why he calls it our 12th planet. Right?
I see.
It's
oh,
not
okay.
12th.
Right.
He's counting it as the 12th planet in the solar system. That's just a way of finding a title for the book. It's not of importance itself.
Okay, but that's some quite his book dealing with the Anunnaki. I guess you've read it time and time again, and other materials by him. But that material is not in the average college or university. Would you believe that? And but you say because
the Sumerian history is well researched in our universities, in many universities. I mentioned to you one other time, the University of Pennsylvania has a big department of Sumerian to do with the Sumerian history. So there, yes, it's in the universities, the ancient history. It's just not in common reading. And what put it in common reading was Sitchin's books that he actually brought out in paperback. You can get hardback copies. But he brought them out very early on, if not originally, in a paperback edition so that they would go worldwide, and they have. So there's nobody anywhere who hasn't had the opportunity since the 1970s to read about this, because Sitchin's books went into, I think, 13 languages, and they went worldwide. They're everywhere. Everywhere you go, you can find Sitchin's books. On the 12th planet and the wars of gods and men and the whole range of his books that were essentially all about the Anunnaki's presence on this planet and the effect that they had on history, particularly South America.
Okay, and we will talk about that in a minute. But all those, the books that you have mentioned a few minutes ago can also be found on your husband's, your late husband's, and people say that late husband, but your late husband's website, which is nohoax.net, hoax, H-O-A-X, .net. And he knew all that history. And as he traveled around the world at least for 40 years. What prompted him to do all that kind of travel and spend all that kind of money trying to get us to understand that there were aliens among us, number one, and that we had a history that goes back 400,000 or 500,000 years. What prompted him to get involved
well,
in
I
that process?
George, I think George's curiosity was stirred up when he was a young man, when he was only an 18-year-old, 19-year-old in the Royal Air Force, U.S. Air Force, and down at Andrews Air Base, and somewhere down there they had a hangar which had a captured or a claimed spaceship, one of the small ones, and they told George it was a Sikorsky helicopter or something. They told him a story about it, and he said he knew that wasn't true, and he started inquiring, And then he had experiences with seeing UFOs over the years, over the next several years. And eventually he decided that he would start a publishing company primarily to publish the works of whistleblowers. He knew some people who had come out of the CIA originally, and they were telling some stories about what was going on in government. And nobody would publish the books they were writing. So George got busy and started a publishing company, America West, and began publishing these books. And then he got into the UFOs and came across the Billy Myers material, went to Switzerland, met Billy Myers, had an interaction with Semyasi and Quetzal. They asked him to publish a book for them, which was The Handbook of the New Paradigm. And so these people who were claiming to be extraterrestrial Pleiadians dictated the books to him. He published first the handbook and then the two subsequent books, and then a little booklet called Messages to the Ground Crew. So there was the handbook, Something Over the Rainbow or To the Rainbow, and a book called Becoming. Becoming is a nice little spiritual book. I quite like that one. And that's how he really got so involved with it all, through having his publishing company and putting those books out. He would go out every weekend or every other weekend to groups all over the country, talking to them about what was happening on the planet. And he got all his information from these people that he knew in government, through his own history and connection with government, and through connections that he maintained in government. So he was getting his information straight, as it were, from the horse's mouth. And he would go out and tell people, this is what's happening in our country, this is what's happening on the planet, and this is what you need to be prepared for. So George's original interest was not really the ETs and the UFOs. His original interest was economics, the global economics, and helping people or advising people on how to prepare for the really hard times that were coming, you know, preparation for the 2008 crash and things. So that was, he'd been doing that work a long time before he published the handbooks for the extraterrestrials. And when he published those, they seem to kind of take over and become the bigger focus of what he was talking about, this necessity for spiritual renewal on the planet. So that was basically George's interest.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I interviewed him, my first time I met him in 1992, and he brought with him on that interview, and I have to play that one of these days, with Colonel Wendell Stevens, who wrote 18 books on the subject.
Yes.
Let's talk about Colonel Wendell Stevens a bit. He's gone now. He crossed over. But let's talk about his expertise, his talent, and why Joyce was so close to him and helped him publish the 18 books, which may be still found if you look at nohoax.net. It's probably still being able to find it on that website. Talk about Wendell for a minute.
You know, I only met Wendell Stevens once briefly at a UFO conference, not long before he died. But George knew him very well, and he knew his daughter. And even after Wendell passed, George had all the manuscripts, I believe, for Wendell's books, and his daughter gave George permission to go ahead with them. But the project never got done, simply because George himself died, you know, within a year or so of Wendell. So it sadly never got done. And his books are, Wendell's books are very difficult to find now. They were not a mass publishing. I think Wendell had them published himself, and there was not a massive print of them. So they're kind of hard to find these days, I believe. But he was a most interesting man with a huge, huge range of experiences himself that he would talk, when I'm talking about Wendell, that he would, you know, talk about at the UFO conferences and discuss. He was highly respected because he was a brilliant man. You know, there was no, he was not some quirky person who wears tin hats. He wasn't like that at all. He was very grounded, very down to earth, and very knowledgeable. And his experiences were quite remarkable. They covered such a wide area of interactions with other people, with other people's stories, and with his own experiences. So I would say if anybody is interested in, they can get a hold of Wendell's books. They're well worth reading.
Of course. And he was also in the Air Force, and he was a colonel, and he was a pilot for many,
yeah.
many, yeah. Right.
Yes. Brilliant man. Brilliant.
Brilliant man, yeah. But however, George also talked about soul energy, and I wanted to address that. Here's just a small clip, but let's address that issue of soul energy.
Exists right now, and what we're creating. And it's not only the we, it's everybody else that's involved in their thought processes that is being coalesced from the creation in order to try to figure a way to come back out of this with the least destruction to the soul energy.
Absolutely.
And that's what we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And the soul has to wake up and say, wait a minute, there's something above me. See, the ego keeps you back down to the me, I, and all that kind of stuff. We're all together. I love you all. We don't care. We're all one.
All right, let's talk about that soul energy he's talking about. Could you expand on that?
I don't know what George was talking about.
Oh, okay.
I honestly do not know what George was talking about. I know what I would be talking about with soul energy, but I
Please.
Mean I can't say whether we were actually talking about the same thing at that time. To me, the energy that activates the individual soul is what we would otherwise call the divine spark, that charge of energy that comes directly and only from the source of everything, and that is the activation of life, and that when you receive that activation as an individualized unit or expression of the source, as a person, as a whatever you are, right, then you have the use of that energy from the time it's given to you for as long as you keep adding to it. In other words, it's kind of like, you know, if you put a charged battery in a car, the car will keep running and the battery will keep self-charging so long as you run the vehicle, put miles on it, or you just do stops and starts all the time. The battery will drain away. You're not feeding anything, and you wake up one morning with a dead battery. But if you look after that battery and take it on a long run every day, it's going to recharge itself. And essentially, this is what happens with the soul. You are given as a gift the divine spark that makes you alive, a living being, and that energy belongs to you. It's up to you by the choices you make through your life to add energy to it. Every time you make a good choice, a choice which is in harmony with the universe and the creation, then you add energy, and that is soul energy, right? That is, you build your soul. You build the energy of your soul around that divine spark, like a pearl in an oyster. And every time you get it right, you add energy. You polish the pearl. Every time you get it really, really wrong, then you draw energy to keep you alive. And so you're using up your soul energy and you have less. So the goal is to try and make right choices and add energy to your soul.
Okay.
And this is an ongoing process from lifetime to lifetime.
Okay. You know, I've talked to people who have said that on planet Earth, the distinct feature of being human, number one, is have a soul. But, and then that same person told me that of all the species in the universe that they knew, and then there are hundreds of thousands, millions, I guess billions of entities. I mean, you can't get to know them all, and you can confirm that or not, that none of them have soul, but but the human being here on Earth. Is that true, or is it? Am I wrong?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know every being who ever existed or doesn't exist in the universe. I don't know that, but I do know that we're not the only ones with soul potential, because we're not the only sentient beings who have ever existed in the universe. And therefore, we are not the only ones who've had the potential for going forward with souls. There is, however, a distinct difference, and this is true about Earth humans. We do have a different thing because of the Anunnaki, right? Now, let me put it this way. This is not a short story. Don't ask me for a short answer.
No. We don't need short stories.
Okay. Right. What I just said about the soul, keep that in mind. The soul is the divine spark with energy that you build around it, like a pearl in an oyster. That is how your soul is, right? Now, that divine spark came from the source, belongs to the source, and can always go back to the source, right? The pearl, the soul, the energy around it that you have created through a lifetime belongs to you. You carry that forward, and if you have enough energy at the moment that you die to carry your soul forward into another life, you have that same soul energy to start the next life. And you keep adding and adding and adding from lifetime to lifetime to lifetime. It is always your soul and your soul energy. However, that lifetime to lifetime reincarnational process lasts as long as your creation lasts. Now, look at science and see what happens in the universe. Planets evolve in the universe, whether they're made of stardust or whatever. You get a planet, and that planet is in a system with a sun that gives it life, right? That sun eventually dies, as our sun will in a few billion years. That sun dies. It goes red dwarf, I think they call it. The heat goes, and everything on that planet dies. It just becomes a frozen lump of rock again. Now, hear what I just said. Everything dies, including all those people. And only the energy from the original energy from the source will return to the source. The people, as they are not immortal, they might think they're immortal, because they have reincarnated time after time after time, so long as their planet was up and running. But when their planet died, they died with it, because they were material beings and hadn't developed their spirituality. In order to continue as an immortal being, you have to not only use the material life to have the sensory experiences from which you can learn, but you have to have the spiritual life, which you are applying your learning to do, to develop and to develop your soul energy. Now, the great thing about Earth and the connection with the Anunnaki, and I know there have been other planets connected with the Anunnaki through the millennia, so I'm sure there have been other planets out there that have the same story I'm just going to tell you right now. The Anunnaki did the genetic engineering, and they took out four genes out of the human, and they put in two of their own genes. Now, this is super important, because the Anunnaki are immortal beings. That is to say, they are beings of light, created out of light by the Creator from the beginning. They have always been creatures of light. They are not birthed out of a physical reality. They didn't rise up from some ocean and, you know, crawl ashore and develop arms and legs and become human, or they didn't do any of those things related to the physical. They were put into the universe, fully formed by the Creator as beings of light. So they were immortal beings from the beginning. They have never been anything else but immortal beings. Beings of light. And when they did the genetic engineering, although they were wrong to do it, and they shouldn't have interfered, and they're in big trouble for it, nonetheless, they gave humanity on this planet a great gift when they give them two of their own genes, because now they have given humanity on planet Earth the ability to become immortals, true immortals, so that when our sun at 5 billion years from now dies and the planet and all our little quadrant of creation goes into oblivion, human souls do not need to disappear, do not need to lose their self-awareness. They can continue on indefinitely if they choose to, if they claim their immortality and choose to develop their spiritual selves, choose to advance their souls, choose to expand their spiritual learning, then they too can become immortals and supersede all physical life and death. That's the gift of the Anunnaki to humanity. And that's what we almost never hear about. We only hear the criticism of the Anunnaki. And I agree, they did all those bad things. They deteriorated themselves from the beings they originally were. They've fallen way, way low, in their density and everything else. But it doesn't change the fact that they were beings, are beings of the beginning, are true immortals, and have given that gift for potential immortality to every human on the planet. That's why one of the main reasons why everybody wants to come to this planet. That all the billions of souls that are crowding onto this planet, because this is the place where you can become immortal. This is the place where you can conquer death. And you cannot do that anywhere else in the universe. And Christ came and told you that himself. He said, if you do it the way I tell you, if you follow my way, you can have eternal life, means you become an immortal, as opposed to if you don't do what I tell you, you will die. When the planet dies, you're gone.
So the human being can attain immortality.
Absolutely.
How many incarnations would that take? Or is it dependent upon...
You know what? It isn't a matter of quantity. It's quality.
Uh-huh.
It's not quantity. Right. I remember David giving me years and years ago, 20-odd years ago, I put together a little book of the teachings of David, different things he'd told me. It was called The Chalice of the Dove. And in there, there's one page... And the facing page has like a pin man drawing that I did, which is a terrible drawing, but it's a picture of a person standing and lines coming out from them. And the lines, one line goes to the physical and then the mental and then the emotional, then the spiritual. All right. And the little page of instruction that goes with it tells you that if you can live in such a way that your choices are going to be putting other people before yourself, never putting yourself first, always putting other people before yourself, and then detach step by step from the reality that you live in. First, you detach from material things. Well, that's fairly easy to do. We can all let go of material things if we want to. And then we detach from the emotional things, the things that we, just feel very emotional about. But we actually have an emotional attachment to almost everything. And then we detach from the things that we are mentally attached to, which is probably the hardest, because what we know is what we value most in ourselves. So letting go of our status, of our knowledge, of our position in life. You know, if you're a doctor, getting to the point where you want people to call you Joe, not doctor, right? When you get to that stage, that's pretty hard to do because it's taken you many years to become a doctor. So letting go of the things we know, of our knowledge, in my experience, is the hardest thing to do. But when you have detached physically, emotionally, and mentally from the things in this life, then your only connection with your soul is your spiritual body. And so you are living true spirit. You are, your soul is directing your life, not, you know, your paycheck or your banker or money or position, but spirit. And when you get to that stage, I remember David telling me that if somebody was really serious, they could easily go through that process in 2 years. And he said, and if they are determined and absolutely 100% ready to put themselves through that process, they could put themselves through in 2 weeks if they wanted to.
Wow.
And so how long it takes to reach that level where your spiritual self is running your life is entirely up to you. We can all do it, and it's not hard to do, or at least certainly not hard to understand how to do it, right? But it's sometimes difficult to let go of things. And until we can let go of everything and really not have concerns, and of course, the great biggie, and I know you and I have spoken of this before, the biggest thing and the hardest thing for most of us to let go of is fear. Fear in all its forms. Fear we won't have a roof over our head. Fear we won't have enough money to pay our bills. Fear is the thing that controls us. And it's the thing most used by the bad people on the planet to control and manipulate us, is our fear. So learning to let go of fear is the very hardest thing that any of us can do, I think. But it's necessary, because without letting go and detaching bind you to this planet, including fear, right, you're never going to be able to love unconditionally. And until you have humility and can love unconditionally, you're not going to be able to truly advance your soul to where it needs to become an immortal being. So it's a hard road to walk. But it's a simple road to walk. It really is a straight and narrow way. You know, they talk about the straight and narrow way. Well, that's what it is. It's like following the railroad track of humility and unconditional love. But those two things are not possible when you still have attachments to the things that exist in the material world. And until you do the detaching, you can't truly have faith and trust of spirit, trust in higher authority, trust that there is a creator somewhere out there who really cares about you, trust that your needs will be taken care of. We're told, you know, about the lilies in the field. You know, we should be like the lilies in the field who don't have cares at all. Well, it's very hard to be a lily in the field on this planet for anybody, because we have so much going on. So the path of detachment is important, very important.
Okay, but did you write about that in your books? Let's talk about the book, and I think
the little book has, the little book has the instruction in on how to walk that path, yes.
And that's on that website, nohoax.net, right?
Yes.
It's available.
Yes. They have it there. They have that book there. Mm.
All right. Let's talk about what's in your book. I mean, why did you write those books? And what was the essence of writing the book in a paragraph or two?
Oh, well, the essence was to offer practical, short, and truthful instructions, which I had received directly from spirit. Right. This is not from anybody else or from my own thinking or from books I read. It was all direct information from spirit that was given to me to teach me, and that I used all those pieces of information. Basically, the book was put together in a question and answer form. So a question was asked and then answered by what spirit had said about it. And that's what that book is.
Okay.
Questions and answers from spirit.
Right.
Directly.
So, okay. All right. And so is David is your guide. He's on the other side, right?
Right. Right.
And how many incarnations has he been with you?
I've known him forever. I've known him as long as I've known myself. Really.
Well, how long have you known yourself?
Thousands of years. Well, I've known myself. I've known myself as me, different me's, but me, probably for about at least half a million years. And
wow.
Before that, I have memory of just being an energy out in the universe. And at that time, I was looking like a great big pink praying mantis. That's what I used
wow.
to look like, a big praying mantis, a pink energy, big ball of pink energy. That was just free in the universe. And I even remember that. And I wasn't a person then.
Wow.
I became a person in Atlantis.
Okay.
Atlantis is my oldest memory of being a person.
And that's about, what, 20,000 years ago?
Oh, no. That's I'm thinking back maybe half a million years.
Wow. So you keep coming in and out of incarnations. Why? Why? I mean, you haven't reached nirvana yet?
Well, it's because I'm an immortal, and I know I am.
Okay.
So I move from one lifetime to another. And when I'm an Anunnaki, it's not that an immortal, remember, immortal means essentially that you've mastered death, but it doesn't mean that you can't be killed, right? So at the end of Atlantis, I was killed, and I was lost for a long time. Some hundreds, thousands of years, I was lost. And you can get lost in the darkness of space. I was just you might say it's like being unconscious for a very long time. And then I was rescued again by the Anunnaki. Again, they found me, right? They knew I was missing. They found me, they picked me up, and they rebirthed me to one of their families, right? So I was literally physically reborn as an Anunnaki. And it was with them that I came to this planet. And then when I was in South America, I was killed again. And that killing was particularly bad because the priest who captured me cut out my heart with an obsidian knife and threw the living heart while it was still beating into the fire. And fire is transforms things. Fire is the one thing that changes things. It transforms them into something else. And so when a heart is beating, your soul energy is held in hydrogen molecules at the base of the heart. And so when the heart is beating, your soul is living within you in the base of your heart. And when these evil priests who did blood sacrifice ripped my heart out, normally they would eat it so that they would take the blood of their sacrifice and put that energy into themselves. But in this case, the priest had deliberately captured and killed me because he was angry with my grandfather and wanted to get back at him. So he took my heart, still beating, and threw it into the fire at the top of the temple. And that transformed or changed or scattered, you might say, my soul energy. It was thrown to the winds all over. So when a few short years later, maybe 100 years or so later, the group left South America, I could not leave with them because I'd been killed in this particular way. And so my soul energy was not collected. It was all over the place. And I had to rebirth as an Earth human to stay on the planet long enough to recollect my soul energy, which was scattered all over this planet, right? It's been scattered to the four winds. And so I have been reincarnating on this planet for 4,500 years as an Earth human. So I've always known my history. I've always known who I was. I was always, to a greater or lesser degree, clairvoyant. One of the gifts on the same frequency, almost the same frequency as clairvoyance, is healing, right? And so through the centuries, you know, those two frequencies are very close to one another. Sometimes you can do healing. Sometimes you can be a clairvoyant. It's almost interchangeable. And so many, many times I have done healing work In fact, I've always done some level of healing work because as an Anunnaki, I was in the medical profession. I was just a junior, but I was lined up to go back to med school to be a doctor. And I was a medical technician with the Anunnaki. That was my job. Everybody has jobs. You might be an immortal, but where you're always, always in a body or out of a body through all eternity. And the only difference is that if you're an immortal, you have a longer life before you need to renew the body, and you don't actually experience death in the way that you experience it as an earth human, because you have continuing consciousness. So you end one life and close your eyes and open them into a new life. It's that simple. It's one step to another. It's no different than going from one room to another or driving your car down to the car dealership and trading the old one in and driving off in a new one. That's the reality for an immortal.
Okay. You know, you cover so much here. When you talk about the average person, as we have been programmed under the guide of the Pope or the priest or the preacher and the church, it says you either go to hell or you go to heaven. And, you know, and you will lose. They don't talk about the immortality of the individual. Why?
Well, because they want to control you while you're alive on this planet. If the priesthood, you know what the Anunnaki told me when I was back in this lifetime, when I came back to this life, they said, your mission in this life is the following. This is what they said to me. They said, and I actually put this in ETA, that science fiction that Seder and I wrote. I wrote this down in there in case I ever forgot it. They said, you will stand up before the people and you will remove from them the lies that they have had perpetuated on them for the last 2,000 years. You will tell them the truth and nothing but the truth. No stories, no fairy stories, nothing made up, nothing that's your particular opinion or your point of view give you to tell them. Because for 2,000 years now or more, the people have been lied to. And the only spiritual teaching that can constitute some kind of religion on this planet that I can honestly say is truthful is Buddhism. Buddhism is not a religion, it's a philosophy. And those who practice Buddhism are walking on a true path towards enlightenment, towards becoming fully enlightened beings. Now, it's not the only way to get there, and it's not necessarily the best way for Westerners to get there, because Western people grow up with a different attitude and a different point of view to Easterners. So it is primarily for Eastern people, but it doesn't matter who practices it, really. It is Buddhism teaches truth. And if you really just look at the core of Buddhism, the seven pillars of wisdom, and you look at what Christ teaches, it's exactly the same thing. Christ taught the bare bones foundational teachings of Buddhism because it's the right way of living. And now, he taught it in different ways. He made it into different stories, but it's the same thing he's teaching. Do unto others as you would be done by. Put other people before yourself. Don't always try to be first in line, go to the back of the queue. These principles of right living are the truth. And everything else that you have been told in religion is just made up stories by a lot of men, many of whom did not have your best interests at heart and who simply wanted to have a way to control you. And they put fear into you. You know, how many times have they told you, the fear of God, right? We'll put the fear of God into you. Why would you be afraid of God? Now, fear in the sense of being in awe of the creator, of the source, being respectful, that's a different thing altogether. So in that sense, yes, we should have fear of God. We should also have fear in the knowledge that the Creator can do anything he blessed well pleases, right? So if we are really, really bad, yes, he can throw us in a big dark hole if he wants to, right? That is true. And it should be, yes, at that little touch of, hey, I better mind my manners, I better behave. But to build into us the fear of God threatening us with hell and damnation, this is just evil. It's evil. And it's not right. And it's not true.
A guy years ago, he came to Baltimore. It was Reverend James Bevels. He was the strategist for Martin Luther King in terms of the movement back in the day. So he's gone now. But if people wanted to, and he said that the basic religions of the world, Protestant, Catholic, Methodist, whatever, Seventh-day Adventist. He said that they had three cornerstones in those religions, the fear of death to murder and sexual oppression. Do you look at it like that?
I would absolutely agree with that. I have no problem with those remarks whatsoever. Yeah, I can support that. What has every church done? Tried to get more members and told them to overbreed till they've overbred the population. And now humanity really needs to be culled, which is a horrible thought. But we have eaten, like any great herd of creatures, we've eaten ourselves out of house and home. Half the people on the planet today, more than half, two-thirds of the people living on the planet today do not have clean drinking water. There is not enough water to go around. The air is so polluted that you can hardly breathe, right? It's so bad. When I was a girl, they used to say there was 16% oxygen in the atmosphere. That's what I was taught in physics in school, right? Well, now they tell us there's 12% oxygen in the atmosphere. We soon won't be able to breathe our air. So humanity has overbred, without question. Indiscriminate sexual activity is not desirable for the perpetuation of the species. And that is something which has been encouraged from day one, particularly with the Catholic Church, where and also with the Quran, where they tell you that every child is a gift from God and the more you have, the better. When in fact, they put that out as a teaching from day one because they wanted more people to control, more people to be their labor force, their slaves under their management. And it's absolutely wrong. What the churches should be teaching is, respect for the creative act. Because think about it. Sex produces children. That's the nearest that humans come to being like God. They create life. A man and a woman together create life between them by their actions. That's next to godliness. Right? That's what God does, is create life. So sex should be revered, honored, and respected, not used indiscriminately as it is today. I just don't support all the casual sex that goes on and produces so many people, nor do I support the idea that having more and more children is what everybody should be doing, because it's clearly not. Common sense tells you it's not.
Okay. So may I say, well, when we looked at what the Anunnaki did some thousands and tens of thousands of years ago, they destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Let's talk, why? Why did they do that?
Well, according to the Bible, they destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah because it didn't have good people, because it was filled with sodomites. I mean, that's the name, Sodom, sodomites. And Gomorrah was filled with prostitution. And basically, they were destroyed because of the very indiscriminate use of sexual activity.
Okay.
Now, they weren't saying that sex was wrong. They were saying that it was being used indiscriminately, and that's the problem. indiscriminate use. There's nothing wrong with sex itself. One of the few great joys in life on this planet, I should think, and certainly one of the free pleasures that we can all have. But it needs to be used with more respect and for the persons. The persons involved need to be more respectful.
All right. Here's a big one. The Anunnaki, they have offsprings, but not in the same manner as human beings.
Yes, they do. They give birth to
humans. Oh, they do? Oh, okay.
Oh, yes. I was born to an Anunnaki mother and father, Marcus and Amar.
Okay.
But it's unusual. The offspring are basically the breeding. It is breeding as opposed to just producing children, because they breed when they want lineage. A family wants lineage, so they breed offspring. And when they have a situation like with me, I was literally a soul that had been lost that they found again, and they needed a body for it. So they birthed a new body for me to begin, right?
Oh,
they birthed it. So yeah, they give birth to babies. Yeah.
I want to stretch out just a little bit more. When you talk about the Greys, the Nordics, the Reptilians, the Palladians, do they don't breed the same way that the Anunnakis do or humans do? Yes or no? Or am I wrong?
Well, some of them do and some of them don't.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay.
You know, I mean, the ones that we call the Greys, they reproduce by sexual activity.
How about reptilians?
You know what? I'm not sure about the reptilians. Obviously, there is the reptilians. I think I mentioned this to you once before. Their grouping is not like a mother and a father, right? Their grouping is five. Five. This is what David told me. I have never personally interacted with the reptilians. So this is not my personal experience. This is what the guys told me, right? What David told me. He said they came originally from a different galaxy. They did not, from a different universe. And I have to backtrack there that, of course, in my understanding, when our universe came into being, 294 universes came into being simultaneously, all separate from one another, separate creations, quite totally, totally separate and evolving in their own way. And the reptilians are a species that are the creatures of another creation. And they came by a chance event, really an upset in the universe, at the core of the universe, of all the universes, the source, if you like. There was an upset that allowed some reptilian species to come through into our universe, to come into our dimensional space. And they settled on a star called Draco in the Draco system. That's why we call them Draconian, right? And this is hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of years ago, a long, long time ago, way, way back, before even Earth existed, right? And they came and they have evolved, and they are a great space-faring species, but they are not like humans. And David told me that their unit, their family unit, is a unit of five of these reptilian beings, form a unit. Not two, but five. So what their breeding arrangements are, with a group of five to breed from, I don't know. I don't know how they breed. But they're not human. They're not human, and they have a different way of breeding. All the species in the universe that are human, they might look different or be a different color, but those basically that are human in their characteristics of structure, they are breeding sexually.
Okay. Let me do this for the next half hour and then be a close for the day, because I could go on and on for 10,000 hours. But anyway, the reptilian who happens to be here, they're able to shape shift, right? So they can become a tree, a dog, a cat, or look like a human being, or whatever, look like whatever they decide to do. So are they the only species that you know of who really have the capability of shape-shifting all the time?
The short answer has to be no.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
It's a very rare thing. It's a very rare thing. I want to say something here, if I may, because although it is not in my experience, I have heard it said that there is a different reptilian species, not the ones we were talking about from Draco, who are the ones who shapeshift and deal with government and take over humans and are generally a bad lot. I understand from other people who have had this experience that there is another species of reptilian, evolved reptilian humanoid type person who lives under the earth, in the inner earth, and that they have been on the planet since the time of the dinosaurs. In other words, they were an evolutionary branch of the dinosaur period that continued to exist and evolve under the planet. Now, those beings, I don't know whether they're good, bad, or indifferent, but they are quite different from the ones from Draco, who are totally alien to this planet.
I'm going to play another clip for 5 minutes, and then I'll let you comment on what you agree or disagree with in terms of this clip about the Anunnaki and about the reptilian.
The most ancient civilization known by the man, the Sumerian, tell us in their ancient writings about the existence of beings out of this world, coming from the stars. The ancient Sumeria had its heydays between 3000 and 2000 BC, according to the translations of the Sumerian tablets made by Zachariah Sitchin, writer, a great ancient languages polyglot. He tells us that in the ancient Sumeria, there existed and visited this world some beings called Anunnaki, which means the ones who come to the earth from the sky. In these translations that Zachariah Sitchin made, he explains that these gods came from the stars and genetically modified Homo erectus to create Homo sapiens. That means to create us. What Zachariah Sitchin does not tell us is that these beings, Anunnaki, had reptile form with a humanoid body full of scales. How do we know this? Simple. The Sumerian left us several clues about these beings, thousands of representations that can be found in the paintings traced in their caves, stone statuettes made at image and likeness to their gods. The Sumerian were the first to talk about these Anunnaki, but they were not the only ones who talked about these beings, these gods. In Mexico, thousands of kilometers away from the Sumerian culture, and with an abysmal difference in time, 3,000 years later, the ancient Mayas worshipped a god called Quetzalcoatl, the famous feathered serpent. He was one of the most famous among their long collection of the gods they worshipped, and which, according to them, came from the stars. The same definition the Sumerian gave to these beings. The words that build up the name of Quetzalcoatl are Quetzal, that means feather, and Coatl, that means serpent. For the Maya culture and other folks, like the Nahuatl, the brother of Quetzalcoatl was Tezcatlipoca, which means black smoking mirror. Tezcal, mirror. Litic, black. Poctil, smoke. According to the Toltecs, these gods were rivals, the same as the gods Enki and Enlil of Sumerian culture, who at the beginning were brothers and then became rivals. A coincidence, a big coincidence between both cultures, greatly separated by time and distance. two supreme gods from both Mesoamerican civilizations. Resuming Toltec civilization, there existed a god called Gucamatz, who was described as a wisdom serpent, the one who passed the knowledge to humankind. Its Maya counterpart is believed to be Quetzalcoatl, and in Yucatan, this god was called Kukulcan. Is it that Gucamatz, Quetzalcoatl, and Kukulcan were the same god, Anunnaki, Enki, who transmitted his knowledge to the Sumerian? Another civilization that also had these reptilian gods was the Inca civilization. They worshipped a god called Yukagari, to whom they call the god of the underground treasures. This god was represented as a huge reptile with deer head, and in his tail, he wore little gold chains. Yukagari was considered to as the divinity of what was underground. The same name recalls to a Sumerian city called Ur. The name of Yukagari starts with Ur. Many natives in the surroundings pronounce this god's name as Yukagari. Another interesting coincidence. In North America, the Hopi tribe, who was located in Arizona, state that their ancestors were visited by beings who moved in big flying shields and that also mastered the art of chopping and transporting huge stone blocks, the same as the ability to build enormous and long tunnels and buildings underground. Hopi tribe calls Sheti to a reptilian race that lives underground and which they call the Serpent Brothers. Same as the Inca civilization. The Hopi tell us that these beings lived under the ground. Yukagari lived underground. And the coincidences go on and on in all these civilizations, in spite of the fact of being separated by gigantic amounts of time and kilometers.
Okay. A lot, huh? That's a lot.
Yeah.
And much of it you may or may not disagree, but go right ahead. You have time. Go ahead. Go right ahead.
Okay. Well, first, it is true, many beliefs have serpent gods. And it is true, Quetzalcoatl means feathered serpent, right? But I think I listened to what that lady was saying, and she's certainly tying all the names together, and the names are accurate, and what she's saying is true, right? It's correct. It's written down. However, let's just step back from it a minute and separate, because what she is also saying is the Anunnaki were these serpent gods, right? That's her premise, and that's why she's adding all these connections on to say yes, and this continuity proves it. Now, there probably are some serpent-headed gods somewhere, right, that have been worshipped. Certainly the serpent has been worshipped from the beginning of time, and it's a symbol of wisdom. The serpent has always been the symbol of wisdom, and it is always venerated as a sexual god. So in fertility god, it's related to fertility gods and things. So that's always true, right? Where it came from and who these serpent gods are, there are just beings who are serpents. That's something I wouldn't know about, right? It is true that every human being has serpent DNA in them. The buccal mucosa in your mouth, the shiny soft tissue inside your lip, that is serpent DNA. That relates to man's beginnings on this planet, coming out of the ocean, just like Darwin said, you come out of the ocean, you evolve on the planet, because humans evolved out of this planet. And so you have that saurian DNA throughout the human species. You may also, as far as I'm concerned, have some reptilian beings actually on the planet in ancient times that some people worshipped as dark gods, right? That's quite possible, right? Saying that makes them the same as, or makes the Anunnaki the same and part and parcel of the reptilians is simply not correct, right? And if you think about it, your logic tells you that, because the whole thing with Enki was in the garden, right? He was the one represented in the garden as the serpent, because he was the one who did the tinkering and gave Adam and Eve sexual awareness, gave them knowledge, the knowledge of good and evil, and made them sexually aware. He tinkered with their hormones. After they had been developed as a slave labor force, he went back in and gave them the ability to breed, right? Now, that breeding process always been represented in storytelling by the serpent, as has knowledge. Knowledge, because the greatest thing that people can do that in ancient times was not understood was you put a man and a woman together and they produce a child. They act like gods. They create a living being. What greater thing to people without any knowledge could that have been? The fact that they get together, they don't know what they're doing. They don't know what the story is, but suddenly 9 months later, they produced a child. That was worshipped from the most primitive times as the most mysterious and wonderful thing possible. And it was always represented by a serpent, right? Reminiscent of the penis. So that is from man's most early primitive beginnings. There has always been that thought in man's mind, right? Were the Anunnaki or are the Anunnaki serpents? Absolutely not. They are not reptilians. They are not saurians. The Anunnaki have been fighting the reptilians in space for hundreds of thousands of years. That battle has been going on. And they certainly are not themselves saurians. They are people. Now, the pictures you get of the saurians were the ones that the dark gods that people, the ancient people, worshipped. The Anunnaki, if you see their statues or pictures of themselves or information about themselves, are actually a dark race. They're not white. They're not a white race. They're a brown, light brown race. And part of their coloring comes from their skin. At least I can only speak for my skin as an Anunnaki. I'm covered with a light coating of freckles. So it gives me a very coppery look. I have a very coppery look as an Anunnaki, because I'm literally all my body covered with freckles. And freckles and red hair are very common among the Anunnaki. That's why you see so much red hair in ancient Egypt. The pharaohs, the color of the pharaohs, coloring was often red hair. It's an Anunnaki hair coloring that's quite common. Dark hair and red hair, very common with the Anunnaki. But no, they are not connected. They are definitely not Anunnaki, not reptilian. I'm not a reptilian. I know that. And I know I'm an Anunnaki. So
okay.
I don't, they're trying to join together an apple and a pear, and it's not going to work. Everything they're saying about those names is true. Now then, I'm going to take out Quetzalcoatl as well, because he was called Quetzalcoatl because when we went to South America, they were worshipping still the dark gods. That's who they worshipped. That's who killed me. Excuse me.
Okay.
They worshipped, but Quetzalcoatl was the name they gave to Thoth the Egyptian. He was the moon god. And when we went to South America and we came ashore, they named him Quetzalcoatl because he brought wisdom. He was so wise. He had so much knowledge that they thought it must be their great, great god that had come to life in a new, beautiful form instead of being the horrid snake god that he was. But the snake, the cult of worshipping the snake gods and the cult of Quetzalcoatl were two quite separate things in South America, quite separate. And all those other names may have belonged to their snake god indeed do, because you read the books of South America and it tells you that was the underground serpent. The other thing is, of course, the Anunnaki never lived underground. They were submariners at sea, but they always lived in the benbens on top of the temples. That's why they built the temples with the steps up, so they could have the penthouse suite on the top. They never lived underground.
Okay. All right. Well, in closing, I just wanted to, you know, touch upon all of that with this broadcast, because there's a 10 billion million other questions I have of you. But for today, I just wanted to address the foundation of the beginning of the human being devised and coming together and functioning as a race of people because of the Anunnaki and what the Anunnaki did to them, in terms of they did give them the ability to have eternal life, which no other species has done, right? So I just want to address that piece, right?
And Christ told them how to do it.
Okay.
Christ?
And go ahead.
Well, that's basically all I was going to say. The Anunnaki gave them the tool, the means of doing it, and by giving them the genes, and the Christ came and told them how to do it by saying, you live like this and you become immortal.
Okay. So in the last 5 minutes of this broadcast, there are many entities. Some people say 100, some people say thousands, maybe the tens of thousands of entities in the vastness of the billions and billions and trillions of universes and planets out there who are coming to Earth. And you had described the fact that they were coming here because Earth people have some advantages. Would you enunciate and talk about those advantages that we have?
Well, the first advantage is that everybody born on Earth now has Anunnaki genes in them, because the gene pool has spread, right? So anybody born here has Anunnaki genes. That's the first thing. The second thing is that because we are separated from one another and use spoken language, not telepathy, as our primary means of communication, that separates our souls distinctly from each other. And that separation gives us absolute freedom of choice when it comes to the decisions we make, which do or do not advance our souls. So being an Earth human gives you. On other planets, predominantly they advanced species which are capable of coming to Earth, you know, the space-faring species, they use telepathy. And when you, excuse me, when you're in mind-to-mind communication with other people, when your mind is open to other people, it's harder to make choices. Because everybody knows what you're thinking.
Right.
So you tend to make better choices when you're being watched the whole time, right? It's kind of, you know, if you tell people your phone is being listened into by the NSA, they're going to be more circumspect about what they say on the phone, right?
Of course.
So it's the same principle. Earth separates each of us from each other. And so we are a complete unit on our own, and therefore we have freedom, absolute freedom of will to make our own choices. And it's those choices which advance or retard our soul's growth. Mm-hmm. So that's why people want to be here.
I see. If you were to, in the next couple of minutes, to talk about the prognosis of the development of the human species, what do you see in the next...
It's wonderful. No, if you're asking me about humans as a whole,
yes.
I can say this. From the perspective of an extraterrestrial observing what is happening on the planet, from that perspective, I can say quite strongly and certainly that there has never been seen before in anywhere in the universe a species who advanced to such a high level of understanding in such a short space of time. Other civilizations that have existed for millions of years have risen to very high levels of civilization, but produced almost no or very few immortal beings. There are only a few thousand immortals in the entire universe, right?
Wow.
True immortals that can move in and out of time. They are not numerous, right? And yet here on Earth, where humanity has only been Homo sapiens for about 6,000 years or slightly less, right? In that very short space of time, those humans, those Homo sapiens, have evolved at such a rate of development of understanding, because the development of the soul is about expanding your understanding. That's all understanding, right? That's what it's about. You know, the Bible tells us, without understanding, we're as beasts in the field. Well, humans started out as beasts in the field, got genetically altered, and in that short space of 6,000 years, at least 10% of them have, this is just the estimate that they're making from upstairs, not my personal estimate, upstairs estimate, that at least 10% of the human species are already evolved sufficiently to move forward to a higher experience of living, to a higher experience of understanding. In other words, they've never seen this before. No species has ever advanced spiritually so quickly as Earth humans have since they were genetically engineered. They've just leapt forward. It's absolutely incredible.
Wow.
And sadly, the evil people on this planet who have been controlling and manipulating for such a very long time, and interestingly enough, in the last 100 years, have become really powerful and really evil, and have in that short space of time dragged back, dragged down, retarded millions of souls, held them back from their development. That's very sad, but still, as a whole species, humans on this planet have moved forward incredibly. It truly has never been seen before since the creation of the universe. That's what they tell me. There's
wow.
nothing like it has ever been seen before.
Wow.
So there's great
wow.
excitement about humanity on this planet and what's happening and the change that we're moving into at the end of this cycle. It's absolutely incredible.
Many
good things to come.
Okay. And in closing, David, your guide, recently told you that as they look at the development of things here on this planet, that something is coming pretty fast. What is he saying?
The original statement is that the end of this cycle, this measurement of time for humanity's experiences, actually comes to an end and a new cycle begins at the end of 2025. Which is only a couple of years away. But recently, a couple of months ago, in fact, weeks ago, they told me to expect major events which would have global effect occurring in August of this year. So I think that whatever is occurring in August this year is going to be the foundation or the beginning of the cyclical end and the beginning of the new cycle in 2026, when the new cycle is scheduled to begin. And, you know, all those who've done well are going to move into a new cycle with great opportunities and a much better way of living. Those who have not done so well might have to do a few more rounds old style, maybe even fall back a bit technologically, because I think one of the things that may well be removed from the future of those humans who do not advance from this planet, who still need more time with Earth, I think they are going to have to go back to a point where we lose things like the internet, the modern technology that we use every day now. I think we're going to probably lose at least most of that, and for a very extended period of time, because it's been very damaging, and it's within that network that the evil people who are currently running things have got their web. It's like the World Wide Web is a web, and it's a web of technology that is controlled by very dark forces who control us through it one way or another, with misrepresentations, disinformation, lies, and just raw control. They're brainwashing us constantly with it. So I think it's very likely that humanity will lose much of that technology for an extended period because it's not helping them at all.
Wow.
I think it needs to go away. It needs to go. And we need to get rid of the dark people controlling everything, that dark force which is controlling everything. We need to get rid of that.
Okay. Wow.
I'm excited about August to see what it brings.
Well, good. Good. All right. Well, you see some good that's coming. Okay. I really appreciate your time. And thank you very much for being with us to go over the basics of the foundation of the beginning of everything that happened on this planet. So I really appreciate you being here. And people are excited listening to you. So thank you. Thank you.
No, thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to really tell people the things that I know about, which is maybe not very much, but it is what I know, and I really hold it to be true. I'm not a story that's made up. It's just what Spirit has told me directly and my own knowledge and experience put together. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. Thank you.
And much of your material can be had by going to nohoax.net. And you with the books that you have written. ETA is one book. The other book is the foundation or the beginning of the Anunnaki. Is that the other book?
And there's a little book called Violet Flame and Other Meditations, which is just a short book of different meditations for different purposes. They're short, purposeful little meditations. ETA is a book that a colleague of mine, Seada from Alaska, she and I wrote that together as a science fiction, but it is in principle a true story. It's experiences that we either had or know of, and everybody in the story we know as people, even though most of them live on spaceships. And then the Chalice of the Dove is the most useful book, I think, probably. And it's above all else a useful little book, because it has useful instructions and useful answers to questions. And trust me, it was all given directly by my teacher, David, my friend, my multi-life friend, and whose real name actually is Ningashida, and he's the second son of the Enki, and my lifelong buddy for millions of years. So they're all the little pieces in there, the answers to the questions, are directly as he told them to me, and I wrote them down in answer to the questions, which, interestingly enough, people had sent in, people who'd had my little meditation book, which I'd just written for the students in class, and trust me, it took me one day to write it. That's how quick it is, right? It's very short, but people bought it after George published it for me. He saw it when I'd printed it for my students, and he liked it, and he published it. And then people got it. It's only like $5.95, I think. It's just a little book. But people liked it. And they wrote in to George with all these questions. And George at the time was still married to Desiree. I don't know if you remember Desiree, his previous wife. But she came to my house and actually recorded all the answers to these questions from me. And then she put it all together in the book. She typed it up, because I can't type, so there's no way I'm going to sit down and type a book.
Okay.
Desiree did it, and she put it all together, and George published it, and it's just been out there ever since. So, and it is a useful book.
Okay,
useful.
Great.
Thank you. It can be got from nohoax.net.
A great weekend, and thank you very much for your time. I really, really, really honestly appreciate you being here, okay?
Well, thank you. Have a nice weekend.
Okay, you too. Thank you.
In the quiet crucible of our personal, private sufferings, that our noblest dreams are born and our greatest gifts are given, and often given in compensation for what we've been through. It is in the quiet crucible of our personal, private sufferings that our noblest dreams are born and our greatest gifts are given, and often given in compensation for what we have been through.